Welcome back to BSA by Design, a podcast about transforming healthcare educational and research facilities through expert design and insight. I'm your host once again, Brian Moore. And in this episode, we'll take a look at safety risk assessments and operational planning. Let me introduce you to our guests, Terry Joy and Wendy St. John. Terry Joy is the Director of Ops Planning at BSA and has been with BSA for 6 years. A graduate of Indiana State University, Terry has certifications in EDAC, emergency nursing, and trauma nursing. And she has spent over 32 years as a registered nurse. 26 of those years have been in the clinical operations and leadership roles with Eskenazi Health and Union Hospital. At Eskenazi, Terry was the Director of Trauma Services, Perioperative Services, Orthopedic Services, and Clinical Education. She has served as an education board member for the Nursing Institute for Healthcare Design for 3 years and a member of the HCD and PDC Abstract Review Committees for over the last 3 years. Terry is a member of subcommittees within the Hospital Group for Facility Guidelines Institute. She's been a guest on this show previously. Wendy St. John is a senior healthcare operations planner, has been with BSA for 4 years. She graduated with a BSN from Indiana University and has certification trauma nursing. Prior to joining BSA, Wendy was a registered nurse with Eskenazi Health for almost 25 years, working as a bedside nurse in the emergency department and then transitioned to the administrative side of healthcare in trauma services. She held several different roles in trauma services, including the injury prevention coordinator, performance improvement coordinator, and the trauma program manager. Since joining BSA, Wendy has achieved her EDAC certification and become a member of NIH and participated in the HCD Clinical Abstract Review Committee. She's also had the opportunity to present with her BSA colleagues at HFSE, HCD, and PD Summit. Terry and Wendy both lived through the design and build process during their nursing careers and were an integral part of the transition from Wishard to Eskenazi. Welcome to the show. I appreciate you both being here. Wendy, Terry, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Wendy, I know it's your first time on BSA by Design, so will you share how you got into nursing as a profession before coming to BSA? Where's your passion come from?
Sure. So I think I always knew I was going to be in healthcare, whether it was nursing or I thought a little bit about being a physician or therapies of some sort, but landed in nursing every single time. It will age me a little bit, but I remember
It depends on what cultural references you make.
That's
going to do it worse.
When I was in maybe middle school or high school, there was a popular show, or to me it was China Beach.
Yep, there you did it.
Yeah. One of the main characters in Vietnam. And I really think that sparked my interest in nursing, particularly like emergency and trauma nursing. So I grew up watching that show, and I think that sparked an interest to move into healthcare. And then really, I mean, through my passion for caring for patients and supporting staff, then I was happy to join the design part of healthcare.
Yeah. So it's a good thing you didn't say, what is it, on MASH, Hotland Houlihan is not inspiration.
Yeah, that would really age me, right? Well,
and she wasn't your inspiration.
She was not.
Yeah. Well, again, thanks to you both for coming on. The idea of safety in a hospital setting needs to come from people with insight into how that world looks and works. So I thought having the two of you come on the show and discuss with me why this is important. So let's start by trying to understand safety risk assessments. What exactly is a safety risk assessment in the context of hospital operations?
So a safety risk assessment when you're doing an architectural design project is a requirement that the hospital team needs to do to look at all the risk for a specific construction project. It kind of parallels with what the hospital does on a daily basis for Joint Commission or for other regulatory. It's called a hazard vulnerability analysis. Like, these are the top 4 to 5 things that are threats to our environment. So those things kind of mesh together. There's categories of a safety risk assessment, and I think infection control, patient handling, mobility, falls, medication safety, mental health, and security. So there are structured, and there are lots of questions in each one of those.
Like how many in each section, roughly?
I think in the safety one, I just looked, there was like 38.
So just a few.
Just a few. You don't have to do all of those, but those are resources that, again, we're not responsible for doing that as an architectural firm, but I find that the clients are struggling with this. They aren't sure how to answer the questions. They don't know how to mitigate some of the safety risk with design features. And so we're being asked more and more.
Is there a scoring on it? Like if you answer so many questions a certain way and you fall below this line, you got to redo it sort of thing? Or
it's not necessarily that. I don't know. We looked at it today. It's more of it's a minor risk, it's an intermediate risk, or it's a high risk. And if something is a high risk, high frequency, then it definitely needs addressed. So it's really more of a kind of an assessment for them to complete to say, you know what, here are the key things that we really need to focus on during this project.
What's an example of a high risk, like something that would score?
I would say that...
I know, I'm putting you on the spot.
No, that's okay. You can answer that.
So I have one pulled up. This was specific to falls.
Okay.
And with patients, a high risk then in a design consideration in a room layout is to design a location of a call button to be accessible and usable by the patient. So that's a high risk for an
inpatient
unit.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. So if by chance they would fall, then they can...
still reach it.
Right.
Interesting. So how would you solve that then? Just putting it closer to the bed?
Or the location of where, you know, if it's in a restroom where they've been up, location where somebody would be sitting on a toilet or, you know, by the bed or movable with the patient. If they're up to a chair, then that you can move that to the chair as well.
Interesting. Okay.
A lot of it's coordinating some of those things with all of the other design features and low voltage and where's the computer go? Where's the lighting? Where's like medication risk are high or clinicians to make errors if it's dark where you're preparing medication. So you might prepare the medication, pull the medication out of an automatic dispensing cabinet in a med room, but you still have to do preparation in the room because most electronic medical records now you have to scan their armband as a safety feature. So you have to think about, where am I doing this? What kind of lighting do I have? What kind of lighting do I have at 3 a.m? So I don't wake the patient up if I can avoid it. But yeah, you can still have a place to prepare and do all the things you need to do.
So then would you guys work pretty closely with like the engineering low voltage team on things like that?
I think during schematic design, I feel like we do. And I feel like these are lists. I don't know how you use this list, but these are things that as we sit in the room with the design team that we may bring up that they may not.
Have you considered this?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. So how have your experiences in nursing informed your approaches to safety planning? Wendy, we'll start with.
So I think part of our clinical experience, one of the things, you know, we talk about patient handling, so moving patients throughout hallways or on their beds or what have you. I have pushed many of inpatient beds or cots or wheelchairs, and technology is fabulous that some of them are assisted and easy to push and others are not. So thinking about navigating through straight hallways versus many turns or getting into a space like an elevator with a patient and two other staff members and six pumps and, you know, all the equipment that comes with a critical patient.
Jeez.
We have been in that situation.
Yeah.
And so to be able to help guide the design process and think about those considerations, because it really is a safety thing. If you can't get everything the patient needs onto an elevator, down the hallway, or, you know, a staff member becomes injured because they're not lifting or pushing the right way.
Yeah.
We can impact that on the design side.
So then are you looking at like even, like you said, so the route that a bed may be taking to the elevator, are you looking at the width of the hallway too? Like, well, it's not like this is going to be the only thing in the hallway. There's going to be other stuff out here. So is there enough room to turn it and maneuver? You're looking at that.
Think about
well?
That. And certainly there are FGI, there are guidelines that we have to make sure that we have, but to be mindful that we don't want to always make those the minimum, because in a clinical setting, minimum sometimes is not enough.
Is there a standard to that? Like minimum plus something, or just don't do the minimum?
You have to meet the minimum, but you need to understand what their specialty populations are.
Like sure.
If this is the term has changed a couple times. This is if they have a bariatric program or they have a person of size or it's a trauma center. So you know that when you're going to the operating room, you've got six people with you plus all the stuff Wendy's talking about.
Right.
A 6-foot corridor might not be enough because a 6-foot corridor is meant for you to be able to get a stretcher down and somebody that's not walking. But if I have a bed and people on the sides, plus somebody else doing a resuscitation or a really high acuity academic medical center, you have to think about how to safely transfer those patients because that's a high risk time for them when you are moving them and they're that critically ill.
Terry, can you walk us through the most critical areas that you evaluate when you're conducting these assessments?
I think that the thing that seems to be at the forefront for me is I like disaster management, and Wendy and I both worked for a level one trauma center. So we were responsible for safety mitigation, and we were part of the disaster committee. And
I feel like that's one of those, you probably don't hear a whole lot of people like, I love disaster.
I do.
You know,
right? And she does.
Yeah. I do. But because I think that you can, if you can think ahead, you can mitigate a surge, you can have the right supplies. And I think, and I think about this in the context, I'll just talk about in the context of ED and from a safety perspective. If you have a violent event in your community, which if you read the news, that happens a lot now, you have people coming in as patients, so you have to be able to take care of them, but you also have bystanders coming in and you're not sure if they're still violent or not. And so you have to have a way to keep the visitors safe, make sure that you have screening processes or that your department is locked down, but you also have to be able to surge in the back and have care spaces for that group as well. So I think thinking about, I always ask this question during design, if you had 25 people that you had to bring in right now, what would you do? And it always makes people pause because
I was going to say, what are the reactions?
Then it's like, well, are they 25 critical? I'm like, I hope not.
But what if they are?
What if they are? Where would you triage them? We talk a lot about an ambulance bay where you can shut the doors versus just driving up. So we try to, I think, scenario testing sometimes. I mean, I've heard Wendy do it when she's with the groups really well, like, this is the patient situation. Take me through it and show me how that works in this design. And a lot of times it
it makes me think of the, what's the, it's Dennis Hopper's character in Speed where he's like, pop quiz, hotshot, you know, like, is that what you, you know?
Kind of.
All right.
A little bit, yeah.
We're going to test your knowledge right now. Yeah. What happens if?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you do that a lot then.
We try to. I mean, I want them to have a realistic view of how the spaces are going to be used.
Right.
And sometimes we don't think about that. The common one that I talk about is with hand washing, you know, and that's in a safety risk assessment too, infection control. So thinking about if you are a caregiver, if you're a nurse taking care of a patient and that patient, you get soiled from that interaction. How far do you want to walk to get to a sink?
Right.
Really? Or, you know, things like that. But people don't always get the word soiled. So you just have to say, if a patient poops on you, how far do you want to walk with that? You know, trying to make it a real conversation so everybody understands some of the things that we have experienced, unfortunately, as clinicians. Yeah.
I'm curious, in our research, have we found, like I'm thinking of, have you ever heard of what they did when they were planning Walt Disney World with the trash cans? They researched for over a year, and I think it was at Disneyland and other parks, and they found that no one would walk more than 30 feet before they just dropped the trash if they couldn't find a trash can. So you will never be more than 30 feet away from a trash can in Walt Disney World. So has there been any research on how far someone would walk if they were soiled, you know?
There's not been any research on how far. There's been research on, you want people to have to opt out.
Right.
Meaning it's required to have a sink in any patient care room. So exam room, ED room. But you want the sink to be visible. I want it to be the first thing I see at the door. So if I'm if I've been vomited on or soiled, as Wendy would say,
I've got to go.
Right. You want to decrease the cognitive burden for infection prevention talks about that a lot. Like, you want to put things in a sequence. Okay. I want to walk in the room. I need to know to wash my hands, then go to the patient. I don't want to walk in the room and go straight to the patient. I want to have to opt out of that and make a conscious decision not to do it versus where's the seat?
Yep.
Well, it's in the corner and I'm not going to go do that. So it's more sequencing.
Yeah.
In healthcare are the studies that I've seen because it is a requirement to have them in a room. So it's not very far.
Right. Mm-hmm. Wendy, what are some of the common safety risks that might not be obvious to those without clinical experience, say like myself?
I think one of the things that I rely on in my clinical experience is understanding some of the diagnoses that we would see in these spaces.
Okay.
For example, stroke patients or traumatic brain injury patients might have specific either cognitive or mobility issues that you want to think about in a design. So you don't want long walking distances. Mm-hmm. You don't want loud patterns and interiors, things like that, that we think about some of those diagnoses and how it could impact that patient experience and their satisfaction in the space too.
Could you both share a specific example of how your assessment maybe changed a hospital's design or their operations?
Well, I talked already kind of about the elevator, but yeah. We did end up in one project look at increasing the size of at least one elevator mm-hmm. for those critical patients. They had cardiac patients that were moving, that were on balloon pumps and had many attachments. And so although it's expensive, it is a safety issue that we talked about. And they decided to increase one of the three elevators in that space to have a larger elevator.
And I don't have to put this in, but did you guys go back and find out, has it been working for?
It's still in the design process.
Oh, it's still
in. It doesn't okay. get out, yeah. but that's what they chose to do.
Okay.
So, and you can talk a little bit about our history pre-BSA or why we came to BSA.
Yeah.
We both had the opportunity to be a part of the user group leadership team when Wishard Hospital, which was a public safety net hospital, trauma center in Indianapolis, built a new hospital. And we worked with the architect and the users were brought in at design development. And there were six trauma rooms that were designed. And everyone was excited because it was one more than we had until we started to look at the drawings and they were so skinny. They were like long and skinny, not a square where you could get around the patient. Yep. So we couldn't convince the design team to change it, but we could convince our leadership team to do a mock-up room for us. And so we did a mock-up, like a true mock-up in a warehouse of several rooms. Mm-hmm. And we took all the equipment over that we actually needed in a, we would call it a code 77, lots of places call it a trauma one, like your highest level of extrication, sure. and put everybody in the room with all the stuff and with the architect and the design team. And they were like, I guess this change order is worth it. And so we did change from six to five rooms so that we had enough. And then we also chose to put doors so that you could safety-wise, close that resuscitation area down because it was where we worked, had a high penetrating trauma rate. So lots of shootings and stabbings and crimes. But it still worked really well, I feel like. And we had overflow area. But you really, until we put everybody in that room, we could not convince them that
right.
it just didn't work. They were like, no, it's fine. It's going to cost too much.
Like you got to see it in action.
Or you feel it.
Yeah, you
like
feel
it. Like we put the design team in. We're like, stand there.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Feel like you only have like a foot to get to the wall. So like.
Which I would imagine too, if you're in a pressure situation, feeling enclosed even more is not good for your mental psyche. Do you do a lot of mock-ups?
I wish we would do more, and sometimes it's a budget thing.
Of course.
But I think in general, clinicians are kind of visual and tactile, and so I think the opportunity to do VR is probably a good thing mm-hmm. for some people, because looking at a plan on a page isn't easy for most clinicians.
Yeah. So what are some of the most significant changes you've seen in hospital safety planning over your careers?
Terry talked a little bit already about security and then infection control. Unfortunately, we have seen in the news not only things that are happening in our communities, but in our health systems. There have been domestic violence events. There have been, violent events, not only in an inpatient setting, but outpatient setting. So thinking about security, I think has always been there, but it's much more prominent and more people are paying attention to it.
Yeah.
And the staff want it. Yeah. So that safety risk assessment of, we used to have every door in the hospital open, everybody's welcome, nobody's watching anybody walk through.
It's a different time.
Right, yeah. is gone. So I think those things have changed over the years. And then infection control, I mean, obviously we learned a lot in COVID. Some of the things that we did were really good and some of them were bad. And so talking about isolation of a patient and some of the things that you can do in a disaster situation and not, I think infection control is another one that has changed a little bit because of the pandemic. Mm-hmm.
I think that just the violence that you see in the community, staffing is an issue. So you may have less staff. The behavioral mental health prevalence, like one in five people have a behavioral health issue, maybe not acute, but right. some sort of anxiety. You can read about that daily on kind of news piece. And I think it's making sure you have good situational awareness is so, it's just become so much more important
Yeah.
Like, you can't just sit at the desk and see what you see. Like, you don't want your back to anything. Mm. You need to think about how to exit out of the room if you need to. You need to figure out how to calm a patient down. So when we talk about, like, a therapeutic milieu for behavioral health patients, most people that come to the ED aren't having a good day.
Right.
Right? You don't like home care.
Yeah, you've said this before.
Right.
You didn't come in because everything's great.
You're not in the hospital or admitted to the hospital typically because, you know, you're there to take care of a problem. It's stressful. And whether you have issues or not, just trying to think about noise and lighting and control and temperature. Like, can you have control over your lights in the room? Can you have, like, because people feel out of control, I feel like, in health.
Yep.
When they're in that environment. And I think just trying to give them options is important, but situational awareness everywhere is important now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Used to just be in the ER. It's everywhere in the hospital now.
Interesting. Terry, how do you balance optimal safety measures with practical operational needs?
I think those two things actually support one another.
Okay.
The challenge that we have sometimes is balancing the safety measure and the practical operational needs with the design intent of the building and the sense of place that we're still trying to establish. I think sometimes the designers think that, I'll speak for myself, they think I'm too, not negative, but realistic. Like, no, that doesn't happen in healthcare. And we're like, it does, and maybe not all the time.
Well, you guys have the experience.
Right, maybe not all the time, but let's consider that.
It's happened to me.
Right. So it's really trying to be respectful of the design intent, but also teaching. I think that's the thing. Like, I find myself teaching more and saying, okay, so here's what we're trying to achieve, but these are the operational considerations, and here's the regulatory requirements. That's the other layer that I think Wendy and I bring to the table. We've been through regulatory visits. We've worked with Joint Commission. We've worked with accreditation bodies. And that's outside of FGI. But you do know what you need if you want to be those things or center of excellence. And really, design can affect that.
Which a lot of the clients we work with do.
Want to do
that. Of course,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. What role does the staff input play in your assessment process?
I think it's really important to get the staff input. They live in that current facility, and they know their patient population. They also know their hospital policies,
yeah,
and their staffing patterns too, which can impact some design. So we need to be able to merge that clinical feedback, that atmosphere that they live in currently, with what those design guidelines or requirements are, with also those regulatory bodies.
Right.
So it's important to listen to them. Plus, it helps with morale and buy-in of when they move into that facility.
Absolutely.
They can be proud of, I was a part of this process and I did this. Some of those things are not possible because they don't meet a requirement, maybe
right.
an FGI requirement.
Right.
And so another role I think that we play is to make sure that the staff understands that. It's not that we don't want to do what you think is the best thing. It's that it doesn't meet that, you know, that
guidance.
We
can't. But we heard you.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, back to your comment about stuff being everywhere. Like, we did that with our office, right? We had user group feedback of, here's mm-hmm. the spaces, you know. And I've heard these horror stories about pro sports stadiums being built, and you never talk to any of the players or staff. And then it's like, well, the sun's in our eyes at 3:00 in the afternoon, and that's when we're playing the football game. Like, it may look great, but you didn't design it in such a way that the quarterback is blind, you know, on a 3rd-and-10. So getting user feedback in any environment is probably good, but yeah, having them feel heard and everything. So
I think sometimes there's a balance though too, is that you can't always just listen to the loudest person in the room.
Sure.
And you have to mitigate some of that feedback as well.
Yeah, because for that person, it could also just be a pet peeve, right? Like, if this is something that drives me crazy and I don't like it, and then
yeah.
it's like, well, we can't do that based off the code or whatever. So then how do you ensure patient needs remain central to safety planning?
So I think it's not only patient needs, but staff needs as well. As we've learned through COVID, that staff respite and, you know, giving them an opportunity is important as well. I try to bring it back to a patient scenario, or what if this was your family member, yeah. or what if this was you as the patient? How do you think this would make you feel, or how would you feel walking through this scenario, what have you? So, you know, that healthcare is people in healthcare want to take care of others, right?
Right.
And
right. So that's why they chose the profession.
Right. So just sometimes you have to bring them back to that, yeah. is that we're here for the patients, but we also want to be here for you as the staff too. But I think that the conversation of what if this was your child, or your family member that was in this exam room, and bring it back to that.
Put some reality to it, make them force themselves to see it that way.
Yeah.
So what safety considerations are particularly important for different patient populations? TJ, you kind of touched on this, I guess, a little bit when you were talking about behavioral health, but how do you address those unique safety needs of specialized units like that or pediatrics?
I think that a lot of it is access control and screening. And really having, there is a document that we use, and it's put out by the International Association of Healthcare Safety and Security. It's a resource that FGI uses, and there are people on that committee. And I wasn't that familiar with it until I started on the FGI committee. And they talk about just presence of safety features. A lot of people don't want weapons detection or metal detection in a hospital because they're worried it makes people feel unsafe.
Right.
Like, oh my God, you come to this hospital and there's a metal detector. I mean, what kind of place am I in? That was the perception when we were building the hospital. Now those are a little more sophisticated, and now that's probably going to become the norm at some point, because you don't, if you are already in a stress situation, you don't want that person to have weapons, and you want people to try to remain safe. So I think some of the screening processes, some of the access control, like for a pediatric unit, in a pediatric hospital, the access control and the screening is it's brought to the forefront more, because if you are an adult and you have felony convictions, you can cut this out if you want, but if you're an adult and you have a conviction or you have some sort of offense towards you, you're not allowed to be within X amount of feet of a child.
Right.
So nobody knows that unless you're screened.
Yeah.
And at the children's hospitals that I've toured or that we've done master plans on, I mean, we get screened as well. Anybody that goes into that hospital, you give your license, so I think some of those things, for specialized, just trying to think through all of that and making sure that we give room for those processes. Otherwise, there's this big long line.
Yeah.
Like if you go to Riley downtown, there's metal detection at every entryway now, not right at the door, but it's at
so far in
so that it seems more welcoming, but that's the expectation.
Yeah.
And I think that some of those specialty populations, that's probably important.
So, Wendy, can you discuss how family presence impacts safety planning?
Yeah, so there's actually research that shows it can be beneficial for families to be present either during resuscitation or during their inpatient stay or rehabilitation. There is some research that shows that what you have to take into account is the safety factor. So that screening is important, and to make sure that the staff is safe when that family comes in, and that you have somebody to support them.
Okay.
And remember that all family is not therapeutic.
Right.
And understanding.
Well, we all have different family situations. And,
right.
And you as a provider don't know that maybe mom or dad or an aunt or uncle is somebody that this person may not have talked to for 10 years, you know.
Right. Yeah. Or may not know the history of what has brought them here today.
Right.
And I think you talked about domestic violence. And that is prevalent, people will come to visit healthcare providers and they've been injured or killed. So I think it's just understanding that family is important, but it still needs to be considered and screened. And then it needs to involve the, like having a conversation.
Their care is more important.
Is this person your person? And how do you want us to handle that?
Yeah.
If we can have that conversation.
That's a good one.
Because Terry and I probably both have many stories of family members that
multiple family members.
Yes.
That's, here's everyone. And you're like, wow, okay.
Maybe
sure how to handle that.
But then again, in a stressful situation.
Person just had a heart attack. I don't know if they need 30 people to come, right?
Like, or like family members start fighting or you know, somebody's punched a wall before there are, or even family members passing out. Those are all things that because of the stress, again, most hospitalizations are not planned.
Right.
Trauma definitely is not.
I will say, and you brought this up and we talked about research earlier, there is research in that the Emergency Nurses Association has done about caregiver presence during resuscitation in a critically ill patient. So if your wife is brought in and you've not seen her, I'm pretty sure I can't keep you in the waiting.
Yeah.
Right.
If you're talking about me and my wife,
I'm talking about you anyway. Yeah. Like, I'm pretty sure I wouldn't be able to keep you out there. So it would be more therapeutic for us to get you out of that high intense environment and bring you back. However, someone needs to be assigned to you.
Right.
Because someone needs to be, it can't be the same person that's taking care of your wife. It would have to be someone, because you're going to have questions like, what are they doing and what?
Yeah.
And then that person needs to figure out if you're going to pass out or sit down, or you need to step out. So really having support systems for the family and having space to do that. Not a huge amount of space, but just a chair in the hall or maybe a private area close to the resuscitation area where I can take you to sit and get you out of that waiting space, because this is not a great, you know, we need to be cognizant of that as well. So just trying to think like that sometimes, how that would work.
So if you've listened to the show, you know this transition's coming. I love talking about the future. So let's talk about the future a little bit. How's technology changing the landscape of hospital safety?
I think there's a lot more use of technology and a lot more available. So the use of cameras in spaces that maybe are older builds that we can't see in every space that we would like to.
Mm-hmm.
So the use of that technology, certainly locking things down or having the capability, if there is a security breach of some sort, to lock all entrances down, badge readers.
Probably in a more quicker fashion, right?
Yes.
Than what could have happened in the past.
And then somebody running around with a big locking a door.
Right.
Yeah. George, I need to lock all the doors.
Right.
And Tara mentioned earlier, it's staffing. I mean, there are some units that are hard to staff and some positions that are hard to staff. And how are hospitals starting to use technology in those spaces? So what will happen with it? I don't know, but I do know that there are some hospitals that are using technology to interview patients or to use telemedicine.
I was going to say that. I would imagine, back to your point about hospital safety, maybe there's five questions that you've got to answer when you're coming in, and the AI could read, like, is this person all squared away? Or
you're right, two. Yeah. So, no, you have to stay out.
Yeah. Or at least have somebody that go and address them. Like, tell me your purpose here and everything. That's interesting. Do you have any thoughts on
it? I think that the extension of care providers is what I see, is that in some of the clients we're working with right now in Texas, they want cameras in every room. Cameras in every room, listening devices in every room, ambient listening, so that if they need a consult and that person's not there in person, that they can put the camera on the patient, give the information, they can log in and look.
Yeah.
I've been working through some of those health information privacy factors.
Yeah.
I also think that there's an aging healthcare of nurses. I won't say that I'm aging, but I am. But I still have good critical thinking skills. So if you have somebody in a command center that can look at the patient like an EICU, like, hey, did you notice that their vitals are down? What drips are they on?
Yeah.
Go in. Then if they have those capabilities, we've talked to a couple teams that are exploring that a little bit. Like it's an extension of the care team.
Right.
So you may have a younger, less experienced person on the unit, but you may have a resource for them.
So let's wrap up with, what advice would you give hospitals looking to improve their safety measures?
So I think they need to look at their own data. Look at those things under the safety risk assessment and look at their own data. There may be some patient populations that they don't serve that wouldn't necessarily meet the criteria for some of those things to review. But I think it's important to start with their own data and then build a plan from there.
Do they ever share that data with you so that you can get a look at it as well and make some recommendations? Sometimes.
Yeah.
It usually comes out in user group meetings that this is an issue or this has been an issue. And then we'll start to notice that. I think the thing I would add on with the safety risk assessment is to do a Gemba walk. That's a Lean Six Sigma term, but if you have a safety risk assessment or a hazard and ask them for their hazard vulnerability analysis that's required by Joint Commission, most hospitals, it's weather events, active shooter, or violence. And then depending upon what specific region you're in, it could be, you know, different extremes like hurricane or flooding and those kinds of things. But really running, taking that safety risk assessment and doing a walkthrough. Like, okay, so let's just stand right here at the entrance of a hospital. What do you see? Do you see any concerns? Can everybody be seen at the door by the desk? And then position people and just...
How many are in that group?
Maybe four or five.
Yeah.
Usually there's a steering committee or there's a lead that goes with the design team. But
and then you just go in and go through different areas. And
but I think the other thing is, I think we need to do that with our design team sometimes, or maybe have the opportunity to either follow a clinician or sit in a waiting room for a couple hours and just watch. That's how we collect data, but helping them understand the movement and the patterns and really what is going on, I think sometimes helps them visualize how to lay it out.
I think it's important to have that as a multidisciplinary team.
I agree.
Because as a clinician, Terry and I might be looking at some things or, you know, notice some things that are happening in a walkthrough versus, you know, maybe an engineer plumbing is looking at all the ceiling tiles with water leak.
The engineers always hear the HVAC, and I don't even notice it. Like, they'll be like, that's so loud. I'm like, I'm just glad it's working. But that's not, right? Like, in my mind, that didn't affect
that's the
operation. But they will hear it, and from a noise mitigation, noise affects people that are neurodiverse. Mm-hmm. And so that's probably very important.
It's funny, and it sounds like this was planned. It was not, I assure our listeners, but and we talk a lot about our expertise and we brought all these different kinds of expertise. Mm-hmm. And whenever I'm recording with the architects or we're talking to an architect and it's like, what's the first thing you do when you're on vacation? Well, I look up when I walk in the building and I'm scanning this, you know, and everything. And then you'll hear the engineers like, oh, I can hear that from a mile away. Mm-hmm. You know, to the rest of us normal people, it's like, I don't pay any attention to that. It's like, oh, this is a pretty building. You know, like, so
I know. And then if you walk into a hotel, like I always walk into a hotel and like look at the room and like, who's here? Does that look?
I look at people's color.
I'm like, oh, you're good. You're warm and dry. No one's going down. But it's just because that's what you've always done.
Yeah.
But the engineers always hear, and I never pick up on that ever. So.
Well, that's.
I'm glad we're a multidisciplinary.
Exactly. Thank you both for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
I'd like to thank Terry and Wendy again for joining me on this episode of BSA by Design. You can connect with them on LinkedIn. If you're interested in learning more about BSA and our expertise, we encourage you to visit our website at bsalifestructures.com. There's a link in the show notes to contact us for more information. Be sure to subscribe to BSA by Design on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube Music so you don't miss an episode. And we've got more content and project stories to share on social media, so be sure to follow us on LinkedIn, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and X. That's going to do it for this episode. Join us again next time on BSA by Design.